Welcome to the Way We Parent podcast, a podcast where we challenge the old paradigms of parenting and work on raising the next generation of rule breakers, because there is no way to be a perfect parent, but a million ways to be a good one. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 10 of the Way We Parent podcast. Paula here. We're keeping this intro short and sweet because we have an amazing interview for you today, and we just want you to get right to it. Samantha and I had the absolute pleasure of interviewing Dr. Deborah McNamara, author of Rest, Play, Grow, and developmental psychologist. She's just amazing. We were completely fangirling the whole time. We talked about toddlerhood, we talked about attachment, we talked about maturity, we even talked a little bit about sleep training. We really got into it in this episode, so we can't wait for you guys to listen. So without further ado, here is the interview right after some words from our sponsors.
Well, I'm a mother of two teenagers. When I wrote Rest, Play, Grow, they were, oh my goodness, they were just coming into their teenage years. So now I'm entering into a different developmental stage with them. I am also a counselor, a clinical counselor working with families in my practice, as well as educators and professionals to help make sense of kids. The idea being is to help a parent or an adult make sense of the child in front of them so they have insight into behavior, what is stirring the child up, maybe some learning or behavioral challenges, just trying to make sense of a child so we can help create the conditions so they can grow. I guess I'm also a presenter, a writer. I just love developmental science. I think out of everything in terms of my work, the best phrase is I'm a developmentalist. So how is it that we create the conditions conducive to healthy growth and development in kids and teens? And also, of course, human development, but that's not so specific.
One thing I love, many things I love about Rest, Play, Grow, but one thing is how you connect what we're doing in childhood, toddlerhood, teenage years to how that fosters into adult development for our kids.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly was the hope, that we could see the long trajectory here. We could see the big picture and not get lost in the details of, you know, everything that our child does that looks nothing like what we hope it'll look like when they become adults and have impulse control and can use their words. And also to counter what is, I think, insidious and sort of invisible, but exists a lot, is how we apply adult psychology to the raising of children. Children are nothing like us, and it is developmental psychology that and science that we need to look through, and not through the lens of adult psychology. And I think when we don't understand how kids grow, that becomes the place we go to try to make sense, because it's the closest to us. But it actually can backfire tremendously with kids.
That is so fascinating. So what we kind of wanted to talk about today, because Samantha and I are both parenting. I have an almost 2-year-old and she has a 2-year-old. And, you know, both of us in our work, we work with families, a lot with younger babies. And it's just interesting because things just get a whole lot more challenging in toddlerhood, in the sense of, like, with a baby, it's easy to say, like, okay, we know we need to listen and respond to their needs, right? And so baby cries, pick them up and do whatever they need you to do. With a toddler, it gets a lot more complex. And so one thing, for example, that stood out to me in Rest, Play, Grow, that I feel like I still have a little bit of a hard time understanding, is the concept of the alpha child. And I was wondering if we could get into that a little bit.
And I think that's true. I think a lot of people, when we talk about this, I think the word alpha is actually problematic in many ways. I just tried dominance or just a different dominant kind of word, because I think that word is just, it's not the best one. But see, we're talking about instincts and emotions, and they're really close to home. So it's hard to find sometimes the word for it. But what are we talking about here? The issue for attachment, we know this is the basis from which all growth occurs. It's true for a plant. It's true for other mammal species, as it is true for human beings. We need a home. We need a place of rest. We need a safe place. We need to get our nourishment through our connections. And the interesting thing, though, is that when you look at human relationships, there is a hierarchy, if you want to put it this way, where the adult needs to take the lead and to assume responsibility for a child. Like, it doesn't really work otherwise. If that child doesn't trust that adult, if that child can't depend upon that adult, if that child doesn't feel like that adult will be wounding to them, like, you know, if you trust someone, if you get in a taxi cab or in a plane, you're thinking, is this person going to deliver me safely somewhere? Can I count on this person to take care of me? And that's essentially what a good relationship looks like, where a child trusts a safe and caring and generous provider to take the lead and to take responsibility for them. It's not simply enough to feel that you are loved. You have to feel taken care of in order to grow. And that's what I don't think we often get in terms of understanding attachment. Yes, we are meant to, you know, be together. And yes, we have instincts this way. But for what purpose? It's for the purpose of caretaking. So here's the thing, is what happens if that child isn't moved through instinct and emotion? Because that's the only thing that will move you. It's not something you learn to do. You don't learn to trust someone. You basically feel trust. You feel safe, you know, in your experiences. So what happens if that child does not trust that adult? What happens if that adult has indicated they don't know what to do with them, or they're too big or too much? The child is a challenge for them, or they wound them, or there's too much separation from their adult. There's all sorts of different reasons where a child will come to look at that adult and may feel lots of love for that adult, but does not trust them to take care of them. And what happens in that case is that the natural instincts we have are to push the child to try to tell the adult how to take care of them. They can become bossy, commanding, demanding, prescriptive. And I'm not talking about a two-year-old who says, you're not the boss of me. I mean, they're going for it sometimes, and you can't blame them for that. I'm talking about something that gets very stuck, where everything becomes a challenge, where it becomes a nightmare to take care of a child. They're resistant and oppositional, frustrated. And I'm talking like a lot. I'm not talking just up and down. There can be eating problems that go along with this, are not open to influence from their adults. They're very attached to their adults, but they're trying to tell the adult how to take care of them. See, it doesn't work that way. We need our children to follow and trust that we will take good care of them. But these instincts and emotions can get turned around for reasons of distress, essentially. So, I mean, it's complex, but it's not, you know, if you... if you've ever been in a group and the leader has kind of gone down and isn't showing up in a way that inspires faith and confidence and security, I tell you, people will start jockeying for position on who's going to be the new leader. It's just human dynamics.
Right. We need a leader. We need someone.
Need a leader, but a safe and kind and caring leader. And that's the problem too, with on the other end of the leadership thing. It's just the other point here to make is that sometimes people call themselves leader, but hurt us. They hurt people. And that's not the kind of leadership I'm talking about. It's about being caring. Good leaders are caring and put the people they're serving oftentimes first. That can be a bit of a challenge sometimes, but leadership should not hurt.
So in an older child, could this be referred to, sometimes diagnosed, if you will, as oppositional defiant disorder?
These kids get all the diagnoses. They get conduct disorders, attention disorders, anxiety disorders. That isn't to say everybody with that label has this underneath. Don't make that assumption at all. It's also behind eating issues, like sometimes anorexia, bulimia. It's underneath the whole spectrum comes into view. Again, it's not the cause of all of it, but it is a contributing factor again in bullying as well. When a child can actually turn when the caring feelings go missing in that child, they can move right into a bully position. Of course, all of these things you can unmake. They're not a permanent condition. It's about restoring this beautiful dance of relationship where they trust adults to take the lead.
And I would like to point out for parents listening, this is different than all toddlers, all children are going to resist their parents, you know?
Absolutely. Well, there isn't, I mean, you wouldn't want to have a toddler who never had any frustration. That wouldn't be a great great indicator. No, when we're talking about things like dominance issues, a child's really stuck and a parent's really stuck. And there's a difference mm-hmm. between, you know, a child all of a sudden saying, I'm not going to wear that, or I'm not going to do that, or no, you can't make me. And then, you know, they're snuggling into you and you're feeding them and you're taking them to bed and, you know, they're up and down, they're playing on their own. I mean, so much of this can get confused. And that's why, you know, the dominance issues, I didn't go into it a tons because it really is much more of a clinical issue, but it is something that I think is important because a lot of, when I first started writing about dominance issues, I would get emails from like Australia, I'm in Canada, right? Australia and around the world going, oh my goodness, I just read this. I'm in my doctor's office. This is my child. Parenting is a nightmare. I need some help. Mm-hmm. And so I was glad that I did, but I think what happens is as soon as you raise it, every parent's like, oh my gosh, am I doing it right? And oh my gosh, right. My child's bossy. And oh my gosh, they were frustrated and resistant. Yeah. Well, yes, they will be, but is
they
it
should stuck? Be.
Is it?
I think that's the issue, right? It's how do we differentiate? I think that's what can be so challenging about the toddler years is that you're constantly, I think it's really easy to question yourself. You're going, is my kid being difficult because they're a toddler, or are they being difficult because I screwed up somehow?
Well, always number one. Yeah. Well, yes. And there's two things that if we got, I think about preschoolers, or maybe three, see if I can remember all of these that just came to mind as you were talking is number one, they're not meant to be like us. They're not meant to be like us at all. They're just learning about the world. They don't know what's right or wrong in this sense. Like the brain's only 25% developed at birth. So a lot of what they're learning about the rules or the limits, restrictions, what they can and can't do, like they're just getting it for the first time. Like you give them a cookie and then you tell them they can only have one. They're like, what are you talking about? Yeah. You know, they don't even know about gravity. Like they drop a ball. It's like, why did it fall? Like they are actually just like learning about, these do not come programmed into the brain. And so we can see as a child enters into the world and starts to get a sense of agency that they're exploring and they're going to be met with more things that are futile and they can't do. And this is how we teach them about the world they live in and how in 100 years from now that our children will face different futilities probably than they do today to some degree. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's beautiful about the preschooler, but we miss in terms of this significant growth from the baby in the infant into a toddler, is the development of a self. Like if you actually look at language development, just here for a second, because it reveals it, is that most children, you know, look cross-culturally from, I can't remember the different languages they looked at, from Chinese to English, there was another one, but they looked at what is the first person that a baby usually signals through their language. And they found over and over again that it was dada. And so many mothers oftentimes are the ones doing the childcare in the first year or so. And they said, well, why isn't it mother that is the first person recognized? Mother actually came second. And if you actually consider development, the baby is actually still fused with the mother until, and so dada is the first separation from themselves they see. So it goes dada, then it goes mama. And then about 18 months, 2 to 3, you start to hear another pronoun. And that is I do it myself. And so you have this beautiful development now of a preschooler toddler who is saying I, and it's just like, wow, where did you come from? Well, the child is growing in front of you, just like their body is growing. Amazing. And take height measurements on the wall. All of a sudden you have a personality. Oh, and guess what? I don't like your meatloaf. What? Where did you come from? And I don't agree. And it's just like, where did you come from? And I like my toast cut a particular way. It's like, who are you? And what did you do with my baby? And it's like, well, hello, this is nature's development. It's her plan. He or she, this child must become their own separate person. And then parents are like, well, wow, this child's got their own agenda. Yes. And now we're going to have limits and utilities. And the other thing that we must remember, that's the second thing, that the third thing we must remember about them is their brains are so not like ours. Like they are priests, they have a whole personality. They don't think twice. They don't have any form of logic that resembles ours. They don't see context. They have an emotion and it can come out of them like lightning speed. They're like the analogy in terms of the brain that I always like to use is like they have a Pez dispenser kind of brain, where, you know, a Pez dispenser, one emotion comes out at a time, and sometimes it can be fire. But there's no mixing. There's no, let me think about that. I feel very mixed right now. No preschool ever says that. The brain's not built that way. It's not meant to be. There's a moratorium on that. And so we can't forget that they're actually just not like us, and not to apply our adult psychology or our logic or our thinking about how they should be thinking at this point. They really relatively are not full of a lot of thoughts at this age. They're full of lots of emotion and they're full of lots of instincts. And then they start to grow to understand the world a lot more. But that's why we trip all over them.
Yeah. My daughter is 27 months old, and Paula, just brace yourself for what is coming. I feel like it hit us like a ton of bricks all of a sudden. She just, changed. So it's exactly what you're saying. So she does say, her name is Emery, but she can't really say Emery. So she says Emmy. We call her Emmy a lot. So it's like, Emmy, do it. She'll say, Emmy, do it. And she'll even go, help, and hold her hand out. And then when you grab it, she goes, no, Emmy, do it. I'm like, you said help. Like, it's very, doesn't know what she wants all the time.
Oh, she knows I'm not ready. Oh no, she's very clear what she wants. But that's the thing about development. It's to-ing and fro-ing. I mean, look at how teeth even come through the skin. They go in, they go out, they go in, they go out. It's just, she's just trying to figure out how to put her psychological steps, like you think about baby steps, but this is her coming out. Here I am. I want to do it myself. But as soon as you go and I do it myself, what do you face? A little bit of separation, right? Because you're out there on your own. So what happens is the brain goes, nope, recoil, alarm, danger, danger. Then she goes, okay, no, I need help. And then she's like, no, forget about that. I'm going to go forward. Like, it's all unconscious. It's not like she's sitting here plotting this out. But it's how nature does development. It's the oscillation between attachment and separation. Just one, three steps forward, two steps back. But it's just beautiful. If you can catch a glimpse of that. But just don't take
them. You make it sound so much more poetic than when you're in the moment and getting frustrated.
And I think it's helpful. Yeah. And when you know what's happening in their brain, it really is amazing. It's like a phenomenon that we can even develop the way that we do outside of the uterus. Incredible. Like that brain keeps doing what it does. It helps me to think, I'm sure it helps other parents too. It helps me to think through that and go like, this really is amazing. She's doing exactly what she needs to do. She's realizing she is a person, her own being, and with needs and wants and wishes. And, that is a great thing. It's also complex and challenging at times, but it's what she's meant to be doing.
Yes. And you're doing what she's meant to be doing. See, and that's where you had that question in the very beginning is, sometimes I think it was you, Paula, who said, am I messing them up, or am I a bad parent or something? Like, am I screwing this up because they're like this? And so here's the thing is that I think that's the place that we go when our children look messy. But see, nature, this is partly why I wrote Rest, Play, Grow. I wanted parents to know, as I found out in doing the work that I did with Dr. Gordon Neufeld, is that nature has an agenda here, and we're not doing this alone. There are the templates, the age-old ancient templates inside of us for growth and development, not just in the physical body, but psychologically. But we can't get there without growth. And we can't get there without support. Just as you feed, just as you take good care and security and safety and provide sleeping conditions and oxygen, all those good things for the body to grow, so too we do for our children's psychological development. But what are the keys here? The keys are about rest and relationship and emotions. Mm-hmm. It's about play. And that's why the book is called Rest, Play, Grow. It is the developmental template. So what is our job? Our job isn't, I think we get so preoccupied in the details that we see. Oh my goodness. And they are confusing. I'll give you that. They come forward. Mm-hmm. They go backwards. They come forward. But if we actually could just anchor ourselves into place and say, okay, my job is to trust nature and to do the work of relationship and to do the work of emotional well-being in terms of, you know, coming alongside my child's emotions and getting that frustration, the feelings, and dealing with resistance. My job is not to tread on Mother Nature here and to trust and to come alongside and to be a midwife, to be a gardener here. If I keep providing the conditions, the templates that are there are going to go mm-hmm. forward. We might not always understand, as we oftentimes don't, what is it mm-hmm. that made that child grow? I don't know. I don't know, and I do this for a living. But I do know that I'm a gardener, and that's my job, right? So just always mm-hmm. anchor back into that. What do I need to do to be the gardener here? What do I need to do to be the gardener to grow what my child needs, right?
I love that. I mean, the whole like analogy of the gardener is something I definitely think about a lot when it comes to parenting. I think it's so helpful to see yourself that way. Like the seed is going to grow into what it's going to grow into, right? All we can do is provide the best conditions for it. We can't really mold it into something that we want. So I love that. And I love that you mentioned the name of the book, Rest, Play, Grow, because I love the way you use the term rest. Because I think when I first saw it, I was like, oh, you mean like sleep, you know, like we're supposed to get, you know, because I think that's what a lot of people think about. But you mean like rest in your care. And I think that is a key piece that the mainstream narrative is missing. This idea that our kids, you know, I think you mentioned it in the book, it's like, we want them to take us for granted almost. And the narrative always around kids is like, oh, they're so ungrateful. Oh, these kids, they're so entitled. They're so ungrateful. But really, we want them to take us for granted. We want them to know, like, doesn't matter what you do, I'm here for you. Right. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm interpreting that right. The sense,
no, it's beautiful.
The way you use the word rest.
I think you said it well. And rest is actually is actually something you would even see in science. Like it's a scientific term as well in terms of rest, or the set point or the resting point in the brain. Like there is a whole neurological shift when one feels emotionally safe and well-being. The brain actually works in a different way. So it does speak to that end of things. It speaks mm-hmm. to the emotions. It speaks to the relationship. It speaks to the fact that we were never meant to make our children work at growing up, that we were meant to trust that there is something here that can unlock. But, you know, this is not the way we have come undone on this agenda, developmental agenda. Like this is not, I don't know where it is now, but it's certainly shifting with all the latest findings in science and a lot of people coming out to say, hey, this is just the way it's got to be. But a behavioral view where you sculpt, you punish, you reward, you bribe, mm-hmm. you threaten, you try to work at development from the outside. If you only give the right lessons, the child will become more mature. We all know adults who behave as preschoolers. They had all the lessons. What happened here? How do you get failed maturity? Because maturity never came from lessons. It came from the dynamics within you that were meant to be unlocked to grow you. And without the right conditions, they don't get locked and people get stuck psychologically. And so we've endured a behavioral approach to raising kids. We still endure it. And our kids do at a great cost to their human potential. But if as adults in the home, we can try to find a way this way in terms of, you know, rest, true rest in our care, nature will do its job to grow them. We just don't trust in it. We think we control everything. We don't control everything. We've got to walk alongside here. And if you want a child to feel grateful, if you want a child to have those kind of feelings that make them civil and social and compassionate and responsible citizens, then they need to have the right feelings to get there. And where do you have those kind of caring feelings? Where are those caring feelings first emerge? They emerge when you feel attached. When you are attached, the feelings of caring come. And the development of empathy will come when you can actually think about two things at the same time, your needs and someone else's needs. That shift doesn't come until 5 to 7. So, you know, we've got to realize that there is a developmental agenda here to show up and be civil and social and responsible, to be caring and full of empathy. But it isn't through a lesson. That isn't how you get there.
I always like to say our culture looks at kids and babies as a problem to be solved. Like the way they act is a problem and we need to fix them. Mm-hmm. And Paula says a lot that we are told as a culture that we need to like toughen our kids up. They can't get what they want all right. the time. You know, they need to like toughen up for the world because the world is tough out there. But it's like, yeah, the world is tough. And so they need a safe place. They need exactly. safety and compassion at home because the outside world is whatever it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And I think all of that just goes hand in hand. All of what you're talking about, the building empathy and how do we teach that?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely, it's beautiful. And the idea of resiliency, again, like you say, you know, as Paula says in her statement, you know, you don't teach resiliency, and the world is tough and the world is hard. And I've been doing this for not quite 20 years yet, but getting closer. And I can tell you, the world is quite wounding for our children. Other children are very wounding for other children. And that really is the challenge. And I think we've got two big significant problems is that our children are growing increasingly more oriented to each other, meaning they're tribalizing mm-hmm. and they're forming cliques and groups to stay alive and to deal with the wounding and at great cost to their vulnerable emotions. And the other phenomena is this of the child taking the lead in the adult relationship and not resting in their care. And these are not in homes their parents don't care. I don't see an absence of parents caring at all. I don't. Mm-hmm. I haven't yet encountered a parent in all sorts of situations who didn't love their child and want to be the answer to their child in some way. And I've worked in some really challenging situations. So I know that that is there. I just think the execution of it has gotten stuck or they're challenged. And somehow these gaps have opened up with our children. But the reality is our children need to feel at home with us, because especially when the world is wounding, because they need a place to find their tears. They need a place to, you know, feel. If we don't feel, we're in trouble. If we lose our caring, we're in trouble. Caring is like honeybees. If you lose your honeybees, you're in trouble. If caring goes down, all development yeah. stops and we're in trouble.
It's so, I love the way that you put that. And I think that's exactly the thing, right? It's like, we have children who are wounded at home, who go out and wound other children. And it's just a vicious cycle. And I mean, we talk about this a lot, like how it all comes down to a societal level, but I think it all comes down to, again, us not trusting nature. Like we don't trust development. We don't trust biology, you know. It's like parents will come to me, you know, they'll ask like, what activities do I need to be doing with my infant? What? I'm like, nothing. They're babies. Like just love them and hang out with them and put them under a tree and like take, you know, like just, but there's this idea that exists that we must be doing, there's got to be this like rule book, this way to like raise our kids. And I think we overcomplicate it because like you said, we don't trust development, you know? And so people will say, well, how can I make my kids smart? I'm like, let them play. I always say that to people. Like I'm constantly getting at people for, they ask me like, what activities do I do? I'm like, don't do an activity. Just, just let them go. Yeah. Let them, you know?
And you know, I struggle with that. I don't know how you feel like with you being in early childhood education, Paula, maybe that helps you with your own, but I was like a mini adult as a child. I was the kind of a child that like was the so responsible. Oh my gosh, she's so mature. Now I realize like I wasn't actually mature. I mean, I didn't have the actual brain maturity. I was just coping with like, that's how I coped. But that's what I was always like referred to. I also like didn't have an imagination when I remember being a kid and other kids playing and me, you know, at the same age as these kids thinking this is dumb, this is silly, like this is pointless, a waste of time, whatever. Yep. Like I didn't really play. Like I just wasn't very playful. And so now with my toddler, I have to bust out of my own shell to allow her to have that play, because she'll be doing something and I immediately want to come in and like structure it and teach her a lesson about it. You know, I'm like, what can she learn from this situation? It was like, no, just let she'll learn just by being.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And it's just such a beautiful example of how whatever your own story is as a parent in terms of your childhood is not the story that has to play out with your child, whether or not mm-hmm. you understand even your own story as a child. Like, if you just know what you want differently and you have a consciousness about it, then you can struggle within yourself to try to provide that for a child. Yes, it will be a struggle. You know, play is not necessarily easy for everybody. And it's not something you have to do all the time with your child either. They can absolutely and should at some point be able to play on their own. Not a two-year-old. Mm-hmm. It's all about being that age. And so eventually they get a little bit better at being on their own, or they're more developmentally able to play on their own that way and fill the time and space. But my goodness, do we ever face, we know what our kids need, but the execution of it and what it means inside of us in terms of our own emotions, our own struggle, and how much our children, I think, hopefully aren't aware.
Yeah, exactly.
So they can just rest. But yeah. That doesn't necessarily, that's where the work is for us to do for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I always say, like, I hope our kids have a little less barrier when they are raising their kids, right? Like, I hope we can make it so that they're like, you know, we are all having to deal with our own childhoods while we're parenting and kind of, like Samantha said, figuring out stuff that we're like, oh, that wasn't so great. I wasn't supposed to be an adult as a child. Like, you know, I wasn't supposed to act like that. And so you're kind of dealing with that as you're parenting. And so my hope is just that we can not put that on our kids, but I'm sure there's going to be stuff that they're going to have to.
Well, and so many parents heal from that too. I mean, Samantha as well. I mean, that is just over and over and over again. I hear that in my practice, right? And understand that as well. So yes, that is unfortunately sometimes our stories, but there's also another story here is which you get through and you survive and you mm-hmm. you know, you do things that you need to do to get through, and nature has a way of answering tough times as well and what we have to do. But sometimes there's sacrificial mm-hmm. plays, and sometimes when we get older and mature and into adulthood, we have a look back and say, now I'll take an assessment. I'll keep that. No, that's going to have to go. I'm going to have to find another way to get through here. What served me well as a child no longer serves me well in my relationships, will serve me well as a parent. And we get to have a sense of agency around what we get another stage to do. I do it myself. It just keeps recapitulating all the way through our life. I do it differently now, thank you. And then, you know, parents or someone will say, well, I didn't do it that way. And you're like, yeah, well, me do.
Yeah, I love exactly.
That's a good way to put it.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's such a beautiful thing. And, you know, I had like a lot of control issues around eating, like as a teenager and young adult had an eating disorder. And it is I'm very sensitive now to the things people say around my daughter about food and body. And, I can see this playing out. Like, I think, so my toddler, my mom was visiting and, she was like telling my toddler to eat something off her plate, like, oh, you need to try it, you know, and getting kind of stern with her. No, you need to take one bite. Like, you need to try it. And I'm like sitting there like, I'm going to step in here. And my daughter got like all of a sudden really upset, like more than she normally would over like food or any. And I said, baby, no. You don't have to eat anything you don't want to. And I was like, your tummy will tell you what you want to eat. And what does your tummy feel like eating? You don't have to eat anything you don't want to. And my mom's like over there, like rolling her eyes at me. And I'm like, oh, this is the cycle. Like, this is how it could happen. Right. There's my mom, like her way of handling food. And then how I had my own food issues that now turned into how I'm parenting my child with food.
But you knew what you wanted, right? You had your intentions mm-hmm. and you steered towards them. And you also made something, you made a choice there, which I just think is just so beautiful, which is as a developmentalist, the choice that we are faced with sometimes when there are competing attachments in front of us as parents, who do we take care of, right? And the reality is that as a developmentalist, the prime directive is always to take care of the child or the person who has the most potential for growth and development. And so if you have mm-hmm. to err on who you take care of here and what relationship must be preserved as a developmentalist, it's always the most vulnerable, because that's where you have the most growth and potential, and that is who needs you the most. And mm-hmm. so as an adult, you made a decision, which was an attachment decision for you, by mm-hmm. the sounds of it, but you chose the one who needed you most, which that's, you didn't read that in a book. That's your parenting mm-hmm. instincts. And so when you say, trust Mother Nature, yes, trust Mother Nature, but trust yourself. Like, trust mm-hmm. yourself. You have the instincts and emotions here. And that's why I wrote Rest, Play, Grow. And I tried to write it in a way that was constantly the message. I'm not mm-hmm. going to give you top 10 tips here to stick on your fridge. Mm-hmm. Please take this into your eyes, into your heart, into your mind. Make sense of the child in front of you and lead with your own intuition and with your own sense making, because that child will see you as an adult just come to life in a way yeah. that inspires confidence, which is exactly what a child needs.
Mm-hmm. I love how you contextualize that, like the fact that we take care of the most vulnerable. And I think,
yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's so, so relevant. Because I think a lot of us, if we've ever had issues with our own parents, you know, like we all kind of have our things. It's so different when our own children are involved. And because it's like, you know, I could, you know, if my mom makes a comment that makes me annoyed, I can like roll my eyes and whatever. But if it has to do with my child, it's like, no, hold on a second. I have someone to take care of right now, so I'm not going to put up with that, right? So it's so different. I think it's so amazing what happens to us when we become parents, and how much more brave we are, how much more, I think, I don't know. I just think like parents are, I don't know if you find this as well, like parents are amazing. Like, you know, the amount of the drive that we have to get things done and to trust ourselves is just incredible.
And to that point, it's in us. It's there inside of all of us as a parent. You know, just like you said, nobody taught me specifically how to handle the exact situation that I was in or any other situation that comes up with parenting, but it's empowering to feel like, oh, that is within me and I can act on that and be true to like what feels right and compassionate and caring for this vulnerable relationship with my child. I think it's empowering for parents to understand the basis of that. Like, oh yeah, when I feel like maybe I don't want to spank my toddler, like I was spanked as a child, just as a very base example. It's like empowering to go, there's a good reason for that. I feel that way. There's a good reason why I'm resisting that. And it's empowering to listen to that and kind of lean into that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it comes back to what I said earlier in terms of our children. You know, if our children lose their caring, then development goes down. But you see the long trajectory here. Caring is what grows all of us up at all ages. Like it's that mm-hmm. caring enough to sit in the middle of the conflict and the challenge and the sacrifice and the second guessing. If you don't care, you're not actually moved in that direction. So when you say it's in us, mm-hmm. yes, I would say caring is in us. And that's
yeah.
That's what our human superpower is. If it goes missing, that's we're in trouble, though.
That is so, so powerful. I think, and I, you know, you mentioned like how you wrote the book to not be like a step-by-step, but rather like a guide. And I think that is why it's such it's something I recommend to parents, because it's really about making sense of childhood. It's not about yeah. how to fix it or how to, it's not a how-to. And so I wanted to talk about, you mentioned it briefly, but something that I think is so helpful, a helpful concept for people to understand is the idea of mixed feelings. And, you know, that 5 to 7 or 7 to 9 shift, because we see this a lot. And, you know, as you know, I'm in the sleep world. So the sleep training world uses this a lot, which is the idea that toddlers are manipulating us. And so we know that's just not developmentally right. So can you talk to us a little bit about mixed feelings and all of that?
Well, to put it bluntly, if an adult is saying that a child is manipulating them, then I think it's the adult who doesn't have mixed feelings.
Oh, that's so
that's a
good
way to put it.
Light bulb, ooh. Yeah.
Well, because I mean, yeah. The thing is that our mixed feelings would bring us to our frustration, right? Which is what I hear there. I'm so frustrated. My child isn't sleeping. I don't make sense of this temper tantrum. Oh my goodness, this child isn't listening or following. It's a list of all of our emotions, which I wouldn't take away from a parent at all. I mean, my goodness, I felt every single one of those and more. At the same time, what is the antidote to it? What is the cure? What is the way through? Because if we only lived in that side, like our children, we'd be extinct. Like, I just don't think we'd be around if those emotions were the place that we led with our children. We'd be in trouble. And when people do, they are in trouble with their kids, and their kids are in trouble with them. So what is nature's way here when you're feeling so frustrated? It's to add an emotion to it. You have to add to the mix. The brain doesn't look at things through just one lens when it develops. That's the whole point of moving into an adult-like brain, is that the brain provides context. The brain provides another emotion. And the greatest mix to all of our most challenging emotions is caring. I care enough not to hurt my child. I care enough not to yell. I care enough to pause so I can figure it out. I care enough to sit in the middle of being completely confused. I care enough to call a friend. I care enough to just go to the bathroom and have a minute to myself. Caring when mixed with that frustration can render you much more patient and more observant. But oftentimes we project onto our children our frustration, our emotions, and it's us that actually has to do the mixing, especially with preschoolers. There's no hope they're going to do the mixing. They've only got one emotion or thought at a time. That's why, you know, one of the most popular quotes of Rest, Play, Grow that I certainly saw was the sentence, there's nothing like the force of an immature child to test the maturity level in a parent. And my publisher, my editor actually, and she's a younger mom, she said, I take offense at that word mature and immature. It sounds derogatory. And I'm like, I'm not using it that way. It's a developmental term. A seedling is an immature plant, right? Like, in terms of
development, it's so true.
It's not pejorative. It's just the developmental state. And so when you are immature, when you don't have your mixed feelings, you're impulsive, you're egocentric, you're not considerate, you're not built for that. And so it will take a lot of maturity. It will take a lot of mixed emotions in the parent.
That makes so much sense. And I think we look at it culturally almost, you know, I hear it all the time, people referring to like toddlers and young children as immature. And I always like, now there probably would have been a time in my life where I was like, yeah, that 5-year-old's immature. Whereas now I'm like, of course they're immature. What do you mean? Their brain is not developed. Like, yeah, their brain is immature. It's not reflective of like what's that's a bad parent. Yeah. Like I think as parents, like you said, we take so much responsibility in like maturing our children as fast as we can. Like if my 2-year-old throws a tantrum, that's badly reflective of me. But it's not, it's just not, because her brain is, this is what her brain is trying to do is mature, but she doesn't get there through me, you know, just punitively correcting every step along the way. That is an interesting way to think about the mixed feelings though, because is mixed feelings. So being able to hold mixed feelings at the same time, like I'm frustrated and I care so much and I am empathetic about her feelings, that is a sign of maturity, right? Like we don't, you know, young toddlers, children don't have that until they go through that kind of brain development process. Is it possible that some of us as adults don't really have that capacity to hold mixed feelings because of our development?
Yeah, absolutely. There's three reasons why you can explain immaturity in adults. The first is that the brain never developed the capacity for mixed feelings. And you actually see this evidence on this in MRI research. And sometimes with when they do, I hate to say juvenile delinquents, I'm not youth at risk, whatever you want to say, incarcerated kids and stuff. When they do research, their brains have not developed past, say, 4 years of age, some of these kids. And so they don't have mixed feelings. They know the right thing to do, but they just don't quite get there. And there's a reason. Brain development isn't fait accompli. I mean, it needs the right conditions. You know, there's a failure to thrive here. So that's one reason why you would see, stuckness in an adult where they don't have impulse control, is because the brain just didn't have the luxury of growth and development. The second thing that would lead to this potentially is that you could actually have that brain growth and development there, but for reasons of emotional defense, the caring has been muted and inhibited and gone missing. I don't care. Doesn't matter. Didn't hurt me. Oh, we just, I got a beating. Look, I turned out fine. Like, you can hear it in the levels of just lack of empathy and just lack of caring, lack of vulnerability, right? You can hear it. There's caring has gone missing. Where has it gone? Well, the brain, if you care too much and to care is too distressing, the brain actually will move to inhibit vulnerable emotions. So you just don't feel the feelings anymore. And so this is the challenge that goes missing. So then you have nothing to temper your frustration. You've got nothing to temper your impulses to react. You say the first thing that comes on your mind. You act like a toddler in your, your meeting, in your role. And toddlers are in every occupation, in adult occupations. You find them everywhere. And so they act like a preschool. And you're like, what has happened here? Did no one teach them their lessons? Well, either brain development didn't occur, or number two, which is more likely, is that the caring is muted. And or the third thing is, and this was my reality when I was writing Rest, Play, Grow, is my mother-in-law was diagnosed with prefrontal dementia, which basically means her prefrontal cortex was losing the capacity, which is where the mixing happens in the mixing bowl and the prefrontal cortex. It was eroding because of organic brain decay. So she behaved more and more like a preschooler. And the more that I got insight into, oh my goodness, this is why she's losing her prefrontal cortex. She doesn't have tempering. She doesn't have an off button. She just is always going to be alarmed because she's so disoriented. And we had to compensate just like I would. For a preschooler, we compensated using the same strategies in Rest, Play, Grow, but with her dementia, because she couldn't find her way in the world anymore. So those are the three reasons that you would see we get stuckness in our adults as well, but they speak to what makes us mature.
So interesting, because I've heard people who work with elderly folks that say that it's so similar to working with children, and that makes sense, is because they're losing that ability for mixed feelings. And the other thing that stood out to me is you mentioned, juvenile delinquents, or however you want to call them, and this sense of they haven't matured past that mixed feelings stage. And it's just so funny to me, although not funny, that society's response to that is to give them more punishments and to give them more, they didn't learn their lesson because they weren't punished enough, right? But actually, we know it's actually the opposite, right? Like, to continue is, if you punish a 2-year-old for being a 2-year-old, it's not gonna, you can't beat it out of them. You can't. And what, it's just interesting to see how people can get stuck, and why do they get stuck, I guess, is my question.
Well, because they have the lack of conditions that are conducive to growth and development, safety, security, vulnerability, generosity in a parent who didn't wound them. They had a parent who could show up for them, wasn't taken away by, too much separation from having to survive their life. I mean, through poverty and, just not having a lot of resources to support parents and families today. I mean, we just don't get it. Families need to be supported so they can take care of their kids. But there's some families that are struggling with the basic necessities this way. The greatest gift is to support them and being the answer to their children. So there's all sorts of reasons. Some of them are inside a parent and some of them are not. And we need to look at we need to also quit looking at our parents as being, as having to do this all on their own. They can't do it all on their own. They were meant to have villages to support them. And so, if they're going to show up and be there for their kids, we got to make sure we can do what we can to support them in showing up. But I think we've got a long way to do in North America. That's for sure.
We do. Oh, and that's come up with multiple, we've interviewed specialists and neuroscientists, and the concept of the village, of the team of support that is there to not only support the parent, which is obviously a huge part of that, but support the development of the child, like be a loving caregiver. Like it doesn't just fall on one or two people in that child's life, it comes up time and time and again. And I don't live close to any of my family. Like, I'm somebody who left the state that I grew up in. So did my husband. And so we don't have any family within like 12 hours of us. And so we really kind of are like on an island, and we've even moved multiple. We've lived in three states since we left our home state. So we've never even really put down strong roots in any one spot. And I just wonder what you have to say about people. One thing, like, it takes a village used to trigger me. I know when I had a newborn, so I'm like, where's the freaking village? Do I call a phone number to get it? Like, I don't. So do you have any advice for parents that kind of feel like, I don't really have a village to raise my kids? Like,
Well, first of all, there is so much futility here. And I think we have to feel our sadness about this one. I actually said that very same thing to Gordon Neufeld when I read his book, Hold On To Your Kids with Gabor Maté. That he wrote it, and I think it was chapter 17 or 27 or something. Anyway, it was about building the village. And I remember being pregnant actually and taking aside at the presentation he was teaching at, and said, you know, I didn't like your chapter 17 or whatever it was very much. I don't want to be building a village, you know, thanks very much. But I got a lot on my plate already. I don't village, you know, building, you know, I'm not a village people. Like, I don't, you know, just give it to me already. So I think there's so much sadness here. We just have to make room for it. Mm-hmm. You know, the conditions that are, we don't live in an attachment relational culture anymore. And this is part of the problem. Other things, economics are driving it. Capitalistic pursuits are driving it. Independent, unsustainable practices are driving it. So we do not have a developmental relational model or culture to raise our children in. And so this is a place of great sadness for me. It's one that I continue to speak about and to write about and to hopefully change with our new generation of parents who say we want something different here. Mm-hmm. So there has to be sadness here. And I think the other thing is that where you can forge connections, it, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, your teacher is part of your village. Build a relationship with that teacher, build a relationship with the school, where at whatever school, whatever community, you have a neighbor, build a relationship with the neighbors that makes sense to you. You know, build an, you know, every Friday night is, or Thursday night is sushi night. I have a relationship with my go-to sushi place, you know, when it's my birthday and my daughter's birthday, we've like eaten there for a decade. And, you know, she sends home ice cream. And like, I mean, that's, they're part of my village. I know it sounds silly, but my takeout place is part of it. The butcher that I go to, you know, the store that I go to, that I see regular people, like, you know, my doctor, whoever it is, they're part of my village. They're the relationships that I choose to cultivate and introduce my children too. And so we have lots of opportunity for that. Does that mean that we have tons of people around us when adversity strikes? No, but it doesn't mean that we're alone either. So just take the opportunities where you have it. I think school's the biggest place that's part of the village now that we really need to cultivate those relationships.
Yeah, that's great advice. And I do think there's a mourning to it. Like, we talk a lot on this podcast about being millennial parents, and a lot of millennials, I'm sure, I know not all, but I think a lot of millennials feel like we're forging our own path very different than our parents. And maybe that is a different thing than previous generations in some ways, is like less of the previous generations felt like they really were breaking away. And it's also, we're culturally in a time where way more people leave home physically, like we did. Like, they don't even live in close proximity. That's higher numbers than ever before, where we don't live close to our family. And so I think it's encouraging to hear you say, like, it's okay if you're sad about that, and just to acknowledge, like, maybe that's a struggle for you as a parent, but also to open your heart a little to people. Like, I think if you are a millennial who's like left home to parent your children elsewhere and feel like you're kind of like on your own island, it's tempting for me, at least as kind of a type A control person who's always been super mature, in quotes, air quotes, for those listening, as a child, I want to do it all myself. You know, that's just my, I think I can do it all myself. I think I should do it all myself, and I can, and I will, and I'll prove to everybody, you know, I can do this. I don't need anybody's help. And that does not get you anywhere. It really, I learn this lesson all the time, and I'll keep learning it, and I'll keep trying. But when you open your heart to those people who are there, like, I could probably go to that sushi restaurant for 10 years and they, and like never, I wouldn't know their names and they wouldn't know my name because I like don't open up to people, but I could. And there is benefit and value to that, I guess, is my point, is to like it actually reaching out to make those connections.
Yeah. I think that's what's made this pandemic so hard. I mean, one of the many things. But I mean, I am like that actually. I live in the city and I love to like strike up a conversation with random people at the coffee shop. Like that's the type of person I am. And so not having that is really difficult. But I hadn't thought of it that way, the way you're describing it as like, that's my village, but it's so true. I mean, even just the nice lady at the store that tells me how cute my kid is part of the village in a way, if that makes sense.
And your podcast of parents and the communities that we have through social media, I mean,
yeah,
they feel like communities to me anyway. I mean, I just, yeah, you know, definitely. I think most people definitely that I met, 99% of people that I've met have been incredible and just wonderful to work with. And so these are communities that we're just finding a different way to do it. It's inside of us to build. It's inside of us to care. It's inside of us to reach out and vulnerably. Yes, that is, we have to be open to it too. But yeah, I'm excited to see what our millennial parents will do this way. I think, you know, the world has not afforded them, you know, certainly where I live in part of the world, you know, all the jobs with high paying jobs and, you know, real estate. And
are you in Toronto?
No, I'm in Vancouver in British Columbia.
And so you have horrible real estate like we do in Toronto.
Yeah, it's terrible. And so I think that, you know, what happens is that it, and also there's just a value shift around. It's just not all about things like the pursuits. These pursuits don't fill you up. And I think that's healthy. I see that in my daughter. It's just like, I'm just not going to buy into that, mom. I'm just like, wow, like that just, you know, pursuit of stuff, the collections, the unsustainable habits that absolutely have to change. My hope is on this next generation and the children they're raising, because this has got to, this is undoing us. So, you know, good on you.
I think it's wonderful. Thank you for that. I totally agree. I do think, I feel hopeful that our generations are changing the way parenting looks, because we do have a long way to go. But I think for a long time, we were moving farther from where we needed to be. And I think it's starting to move towards it. Thanks in large part to people like yourself who are putting this research out and making it understandable for everybody. Because, you know, And that's the thing. We've talked to a lot of people who do research, and it's, you know, on the one hand, we neuroscience understands all these things about kids, but somehow the mainstream doesn't. And it takes a long time for those things to come together. So it's really helpful that you do that. Speaking of instincts and all the stuff that we've been talking about, I just wanted to touch upon something that you talked about in a lecture I just did recently that with you about sleep. And one of the things that you mentioned was the lullaby. That really stuck with me. That was such a good one because it's so beautiful to hear about it and how instinctual it is and how beneficial it is, and it's yet something that none of us really put much thought into.
Yeah, the lullaby. Well, I mean, just the separation at night into sleep is one of the most provocative times for our children. Any time of the day, that is, I think, by and large, one of the most challenging for parents, not only with their, you know, energy levels and also with our children's need to come to rest physically and emotionally, so that sleep can occur. But research, and this is actually Gordon Neufeld's research that he did and he shared with me as part of our new sleep material that's, you know, attachment-based, developmentally friendly, is basically the answer to why we shouldn't cry it out, you know, the self-soothing myths and the fervorizing and extinguishing crying, all this just awful stuff, awful, awful stuff when it comes to development and relationship. That has been fed to parents. But one of the secrets, if there were one, to this time of night is to realize that the lullaby has always been the transition over this hump. And the reason for it is because bedtime is a time of separation, which is the opposite of connection and attachment. So what helps ready us for that, that transition? Well, the lullaby is like 4,000 years old. Some actually say it's the first music we had was a lullaby. It's probably some, you know, very intuitive, tired parents stumbled upon the magic in the lullaby. And what it basically does is it moves your nervous system. It helps to synchronize the nervous system. It gets right into the primal parts of the brain. Music isn't blocked out. It gets right in there. Even with someone with dementia, you can get right in there with the music. And so it has sort of a main line into the emotional center of the brain. And as a result, our lullabies, and I'm talking about us singing a lullaby, not someone else, but us, our voice, mm-hmm. our sounds, mm-hmm. Our stories, our relationship with the child, from that place to sing a lullaby, it gets right into those emotional centers of the brain. It activates attachment. Lullabies are in a tone and a tempo that has a little bit of sadness in it, which is just readying you to face the separation, but not too directly, because that would be alarming. And the parent is in the lead, and the parent sings the child to sleep, sings the child into rest so that sleep can occur. And the research on lullabies actually found that not only was it wonderful for the child, but it was actually very empowering for the parent to feel like this time of night wasn't something that they had to fight, that they had to worry about what technique are they going to use. But naturally, they moved to their song. They found their voice. They found their story. And they sang their child off to sleep. I intuitively got here as a parent through some stumbling around, but I got there and experimented with different songs and stories. Mm-hmm. I don't know, each of my children had different songs. They weren't even the same. My very sensitive one could not handle a really sad tunes like Danny Boy or Off the Magic Dragon. They would be too alarming for her. So I used to sing like Twinkle Twinkle and make up, you know, how much I loved her and Twinkle Twinkle and put a touch of sadness to it. And the other one I would just sing, you know, like Wimbaway or Leaving on a Jet Plane, mm-hmm. or just these really old songs. I never ever sang them outside of the nighttime routine. Only once I sang one, and my daughter in the daytime, and my daughter visibly yawned. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is paired with night. So, you know, if nighttime is an issue, then what about your lullaby? What about your song?
How so do beautiful. Your
voice, you know?
And it's I've heard similar. From so many parents say, sorry, that, and I feel the same way, that singing is also just soothing for ourselves, like for our nervous system. The act of singing is really calming. And so when you're stressed out at bedtime, singing is soothing for you. And so it's just so beautiful. Like it does so many things.
Of course,
I love that.
I mean, you know, you can take a stress management class or one of those, whatever, and they'll say, well, don't forget to breathe. Or you can just sing, because you'll have to be forced to take deep breaths when you're singing.
And to focus, because you're focusing on the lyrics or whatever it is that you're.
Yeah,
I think that's so. And it also brings this element to, like, I think kids really do at different stages. It looks differently depending on their age, but they understand that going to sleep is a form of separation. Even if you were laying in the same bed right next to them, like they feel like they're going to drift off and their parent isn't there, you know, like they're, mm-hmm. they're not there. And it's like this separation. It's kind of similar to how I tell parents the tip of, like, if you want your toddler to play independently for a little bit, like you have to let them decide when it's a good time to do that. And you have to connect with them first. Like you've got to be one-on-one, give them that connection before you're trying to step away. And it's sort of the same idea. It's like, you really want them to feel super connected and like have that, like, yes, you're going to sleep and away from your mom or dad, but we're connected and here's this loving, you know. Well, it's kind of funny because I'm wearing a Beatles t-shirt, which I have many of, but the song I always sing to my daughter is John Lennon's song Beautiful Boy, but I sing it Beautiful Girl. Beautiful. And so my daughter I love that song so much. Like there's been multiple times where I will like tear up singing it to her at bedtime, and she still nurses too. So sometimes she'll nurse and I'll stop singing, or I'll sing her like Twinkle Twinkle Star first. And then she'll like pull away and go, close your eyes, because that's the first lyric to the song is close your eyes. So like she knows. And then I'll say, you want me to sing close your eyes? And
she, yeah.
It's just such a beautiful moment of connection. Like we don't, and to think that that could be considered a sleep prop. I mean, I can't even.
It is. I mean, there are sleep trainers who say, do not sing to your kid to sleep because it is a sleep prop.
Or a bad habit something. Like,
it's a bad habit.
They said that about food. They say that about lots of stuff. But you've got to remember that those messages are from a different approach. They're from a behavioral approach. You teach. Parenting is a skill. You have to sculpt. Right. Have to reward, you have to bribe. So as soon as you get into that language, you already know you have a sculptor instead of a gardener.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I love that. Yep. I love the whole concept of the lullaby. And just to kind of add to what Samantha was saying, that story, my son, he loves Twinkle Twinkle. And even when he was very little, I used to move my little fingers in front of his face, like Twinkle Twinkle Stars. And he just would stop, whatever he was doing, he would just stop and stare. And now sometimes we'll put on just kids music on the radio while he's playing in his room. And as soon as Twinkle Twinkle Little Star comes on, he goes to his bed and grabs his sheet and covers himself up. It's like, it's time for sleep. It's the cutest thing. So it's just incredible how their minds work.
I just have to say, I'm so shocked that someone would say a lullaby is a sleep prop. Are we really that messed up? Like, that's just it's going to take me all day to get over. Like, really?
I know.
From our instincts,
and I'm sure you know, with nursing, it's something. And I'm a breastfeeding specialist. Like, I do a lot of breastfeeding consultations. And oh my gosh, the not nursing to sleep is such a strong thing that people, it is almost pediatricians tell us you cannot nurse your baby to sleep, or they'll never sleep on their own. They'll never learn to fall asleep. And I'm like.
Yeah, well, pediatricians were responsible for timeouts and Ferberizing. So, I mean, we have to what medical science knows and developmental science knows don't always meet together. But I work with some really incredible pediatricians who are very developmental. And so, it always comes back to, we are in the middle of a big shift. Attachment science has been around for about 70 years. It just keeps going through cycles. But now the neuroscientists are pointing in the direction. Developmental scientists are pointing in the direction. So there's a huge groundswell. And I think parents are just sick of being told what to do by so many people, especially when they don't have kids. These people, so many experts. And so just, walking a parent back home to their instincts and their emotions. Cry it out never felt natural to me. Breastfeeding till my child fell asleep. It was just what happened. Like, where did we get
it just happens.
Where did we get naturally. So divorced from nature? Yeah. I just don't get it.
Yeah. It's something that comes up so much, and people say there's this idea that those of us who don't believe in sleep training, or anybody who kind of believes in responsive parenting, we're martyrs. We're martyrs to our children, And it's actually, to me, it's the exact opposite. I'm I'm actually a pretty lazy parent. I actually just do what comes easiest, because it's just what comes naturally.
Mother Nature taking care of my child.
Exactly. And, people, I deal with this all the time. What do I do? My child is going through the 4-month sleep progression. And how can I? I'm nothing. Do whatever you need to do to survive. Whatever gets you through. Whether, that's bed sharing, whether that is nursing them to sleep more, whether that is extra cut, whatever is easiest. Don't make your life harder, because that's what they'll tell you. That's what the sleep training world will tell you, is this is the time to teach those independent skills. And why are we making their life so much harder than it already is?
They can't even walk, let alone teach them life skills.
And I always think, if we're all breastfeeding parents out there are struggling with the whole they're breastfeeding to sleep, it must be pretty natural that they nurse to sleep. Then why, you know what I mean? It's we all do it at some point and have it happen just naturally. I never, you said, I never made the choice. I'm going to nurse her to sleep every time she goes to bed, but it just happens with babies. That's just so natural. It's so soothing, so comforting, you know.
Endorphins and opioids, or not opioids, but natural endorphins and stuff in your milk. Yeah. That actually knocks right. you out. I don't know how you couldn't be knocked out from breast milk.
Yeah. And the fact that people are told, you know, I'll hear from parents that are like, well, what I've been trying to do, it's so hard, is like, if I start seeing them get sleepy, I'll like rub their back and wake them up and unlatch them and get them awake. And then I'll put them down. And I'm like, oh, you don't have to.
I just saw a reel from a very big sleep trainer. Where she was saying that the key to infant sleep and like the newborn stage is to get good feeds during the day. And the way you get good feeds during the day is to not let them fall asleep at the breast. And the way to do that is you might have to tickle them or even splash water in their face to wake them up. So think about that. You are splashing cold water into your infant's face. Like, it is just the most mind-boggling thing. And this is someone who has hundreds of thousands of followers who are saying, yep, let's do it. It is just insane. But anyways,
how social media can cause us a lot of stress as parents. Like, there's things that are great about it. Like we said earlier, the community, the village, that is to feel validated by the support we can get online is wonderful. But also there's sometimes I'm like, man, I wish I lived like way back when the only thing we went off of was our instincts because that's all there was. There wasn't like social media and TV and all of this. Like, parents all around the world forever and ever have nursed babies to sleep. That is like, that's just instinct. Nobody was there to tell them to splash water in the face and not let them go to sleep. Like, so there is a bit of like, we're so vulnerable as new parents wanting to take care of this little human to then have all these conflicting messages come at us. I think it's just, I just feel for parents.
I do. And I also think that I don't think you were ever more vibrant in, what is the word? I don't know. Not vibrant, but just so alert and attentive to trying to figure out who you're going to be as a parent when you just start becoming a parent, when you're a new parent, because it's your first rodeo, right? And so you're trying to really pay attention. It's like when you first learn how to drive, you're like, everything is in your face. You're trying to correct and counter correct. And so I would share a different narrative around that. I actually think it is your most powerful time as a parent because you are using your instincts and your emotions to choose how you're going to parent. I think sometimes we get into bad habits as parents. We get into ruts and we're no longer conscious sometimes, but my goodness, when you are a new parent, it is the time for consciousness. And so don't go down that path that, you know, the world is doing this to you. That's a dangerous path because you will only feel like a victim there and your child will feel that in you. You must take the wheel. You must see this as actually quite a birthplace. It's the full of me-dos. My goodness, do not mess with a three-year-old when they're full of their me-dos. They are just and I'll figure it out. And you know, mistakes or not, it's just
so fun.
Beautiful sense of agency inside of them. So don't go down with that kind of a narrative. You take the wheel, you use your instincts, you use your emotions, you think about what you want to do. You think about talking to your grandmother and saying, well, grandma, I'm going to throw water on their face and wake them up. See what grandma says to you back. Think about the most wisest soul or the parent that you respect the most in parenting, or who you would want to have been parented by or had as a parent. Have that conversation with them and don't be afraid to sit in the mess of that. But no, I actually think you are the most conscious at this stage because you have to figure it out. People get lazy in parenting. They get busy. But right now, no.
That is such a great point. I'm so glad you made that distinction. I think that is incredibly empowering for parents to hear because I think it's reflective of like maybe the ways that I felt vulnerable as a parent, just having conflicting messages. But what made me feel vulnerable is when I tuned out my instincts to listen to other people. That is a vulnerable state, but we don't have to be. We don't have to be. When I listen to my gut feeling, my instincts, my what do I really believe, that is when you feel powerful and, you know, like you can move forward in this powerful parenting kind of state. So yeah, thank you for that. That's so good for parents to hear. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So yes, we'll wrap it up there. Thank you so much, Deborah. That was a wonderful conversation. I always get so much out of our interviews with people and just, yes. Yeah. So everybody should check out your book, Rest, Play, Grow. And you're on social media, yes, website as well.
Yeah.
So we'll put it all in the show notes where they can find you and your information. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you. It was a delight to talk to you both and to hear how you're charting parenting. And oh my goodness, if this is what millennial parenting looks like, we're in good hands.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Awesome.
Yeah.
We're slowly spreading the word. I do think that we're growing in numbers. So
we
really appreciate you coming on to talk to us. I think people are really going to learn from this, and I hope everybody picks up your book and your website too. The infographics that you have on your website are super helpful. Those are really great. And the blog posts. Mm-hmm. So just something it'll be in our show notes for people to check out for sure.
Yeah.
Sounds good. Well, you take good
Thank
care.
You so much, Deborah.
Thanks for having me, and all the best to the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Thanks for listening to the Way We Parent podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave a review on iTunes to help others find us. Share it with your friends and tag us on Instagram at The Way We Parent Podcast. Let us know who you want to have on next or what topics you want us to cover. See you next time.